Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's speaker will be Chris Allen, Associate Professor of Communications at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and former president of the Omaha Press Club. The title of his presentation will be Oman, the Gem of Arabia. He'll talk about his Fulbright year experience in this Islamic country on the Saudi Peninsula. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, January 24, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Today our noon forum features one of our own. Chris Allen is a member of our committee and is the former president of the Press Club. Chris is a journalism professor at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and what he is here today to talk about is his Fulbright experience in Oman. Frankly, I knew almost nothing about Oman when Chris said, "Hey, that's where I'm headed, along with my wife, Elaine." Well, I'm going to find out today about Oman along with the rest of you. Chris is going to talk for about a half an hour or so and then open it up to questions. There is paper and pencil at your table. There are questions, and they will be brought to me. So join me now in welcoming Chris Allen.
Thank you, Gary, and welcome to Press Club members and others. Thanks for coming. It's an honor to be a guest here at the Noon Forum. I've introduced a lot of people. I've hosted a lot of these, but I have never been a speaker, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to tell you about this. Let me just say that 1 year ago today, we had begun to close the windows in the evening because it was getting a little bit chilly outside. And most days we did not have to run the air conditioner. So I really miss Oman right now. On the other hand, the day after we left June 20th, and the day after we left, it was 120 degrees Fahrenheit. So there were some compensations for the very temperate weather during the winter. The summers got very, very, very hot. Like Gary, I really didn't know very much about Oman when I signed up for it. So a little bit of a geography lesson. Oman is on the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. It's on the eastern edge. To the north is the United Arab Emirates, where Dubai is located. Most people know about that. And then it runs almost the entire eastern edge of the Arabian Peninsula, bounded by or butting against the Gulf of Oman, which they prefer to call the Sea of Oman, and then the Arabian Sea as it gets a little bit farther south. It, in square miles, is about the size of Utah, although obviously it's not shaped like that. It's long and narrow, kind of like California flipped over. And it has 1,000 miles of coastline, some of the most beautiful, stunning coastline you have ever seen in your life. At places, the mountains come right down into the ocean, and then they will recede a little bit, and you will have white, beautiful, gorgeous soft sand beaches that run for miles and miles and miles and then end in rocky crags and soaring back up into the Hajar Mountains in the north and the Dhofar Mountains in the south. The capital city is Muscat, which is in the northern part of the country. And there is one little itty-bitty anomaly. Oman, in older days, included the United Arab Emirates. It ceded that land at some time in its long ago history, and it also included the island of Zanzibar off the African coast. But in ceding the land of the United Arab Emirates, it kept one little piece of property right at the very tip of the Musandam Peninsula, and that is one strategic plot of land, because that forms the Strait of Hormuz. And the Strait of Hormuz is actually about 23 miles wide. It's a very, very narrow strip of water through which so much of our oil flows from the Middle East. It is strategically important. And you remember about a year ago, President Ahmadinejad of Iran was making noise about closing the Strait of Hormuz. In fact, Iran and Oman both control the Strait of Hormuz. And Oman is very much a friend of the United States, which we're very happy about. The interesting thing is that the stories, because we follow the stories that you were getting here in the U.S., and there was all this saber rattling and this reaction and this panic, and we got emails from our friends saying, oh my gosh, what is Oman saying about this? And the fact is that people in Oman weren't saying a word, because it cannot happen. It will not happen. If Iran did that, it would be an act of war against Oman. It would be incursion into Oman national waters. And Oman is not about to let that happen. It has a very strong military. It has a good navy. And it has the ally as its allies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, and possibly Iraq. But it certainly has lots of allies in that area. It simply was not going to happen. And in fact, most of the oil on those ships passes through the Omani waters, not through Iraqi waters. It's just the shipping lane is mostly in Omani waters. So one of the first things we noticed was that we get a completely different view of news from one area than we get from here. And I don't know if it's simply from ignorance that there are no reporters on the ground in Oman to actually report this. We only heard it from two or three reporters in the whole time we were there that the strait is actually controlled by Oman and Iran. So for Iran to close it off would be extremely difficult and would be very, very negative. Iran does not have an ally in that part of the country. None of the Gulf countries likes Iran. They all think that Iran is a rogue nation and is completely out of control, and they don't like it. The Sultan of Oman, the king, the Sultan, is perhaps the only person, certainly in that region and maybe in the world, who can pick up the phone and talk to Iran and pick up the phone and talk to the United States. He is an ally of both. He is a friend of both. He's not an ally, but he is a friend of both. His foreign policy has been very, very much hands-off. And the Iranians respect him. They welcome his comments because he is not critical of them. He simply mediates. Just after we arrived in September of last year, of 11, you may remember that the two hitchhikers who had strayed into Iranian territory and were jailed, they were released. They were released because the United States called the Sultan of Oman and said, can you do something about this? He picked up the phone and called Iran and said, please charge them with something and set bail for them. I'm asking you as a personal favor. Iran did that. They set bail at $500,000 each. He paid that ransom. He paid it, $1 million, and then he sent his airplane, his personal jet, to get them, bring them back to Oman, bring their families over from the United States. He put them up in one of the best hotels in the country, the Al Bustan Palace Hotel, and said to them, you stay here, get to know each other again, you're free from the press, and when you're ready to go home, you can leave, just when you're ready, but be our guest for a few days. So he truly is an ally, a friend of the United States, but he can also talk to Iran, which is unusual. What we didn't realize when we went to Oman was that it is a very modern country. One person told us that Oman is a third world country wrapped in a first world veneer, which has a lot of appeal as a description. It still has some third world problems. But it is a very modern country, and the Sultan has made sure that it has become a very modern country. So the Sultan, his name is Sultan Qaboos, Qaboos, Qaboos bin Said, which means the son of Said. He is 72 years old now and has been in power for 40 years. He over... 42 years. And he overthrew his father in 1970. And he did it with the help of the Iranians and the British in a relatively bloodless coup, palace coup. Somebody, the story goes, got shot in the foot. So there was a little bit of blood, but not bad. His father was truly an evil dictator in almost every way. He did not torture his citizens, but he did not do anything to help them. In 1970, Oman was a country literally in darkness. There were, for the 2 million people that lived there, there were three schools in the entire country. It was a completely illiterate country. The three schools were all Quran schools. There was one hospital, and there were 6 kilometers of paved roads. There was no electricity. There was no clean water. There was nothing. There were no roads to any of the villages. People simply lived very, very tribal lives and very basic subsistence lives. Anybody who did manage to escape from there and get an education was not allowed to return to the country. The Sultan Saeed personally signed all of the reentry visas, even for his own citizens, and most of them he refused to sign. He feared education, and as it turns out, he had a good reason to, because he did educate his son. Qaboos is an only child. He was homeschooled, he did have a sister who died very young. He was educated, homeschooled, and then at the age of 16 was sent to Britain to finish his education. He did that. He then went to Sandhurst, which is Britain's equivalent of West Point, finished that course, became an officer in the British Army, served a tour of duty in Germany with the British Army. Then he took a tour of the world. He just took about a year to visit countries of the world, and then returned to Britain and worked for 9 or 10 months in a simple British town council. Be like working in the clerk's office here in City Hall. And then he returned at about age 26 to his home country. He told his father that he had seen many, many things and that it was imperative that Oman begin improving the lives of their citizens and using some of the oil money. For that, he was thrown in jail or house arrest for 6 years. He was held under house arrest by his own father until he was able to raise an insurrection and overthrow his father, who was exiled to London, where he died. They don't say how. He just died. So that's the brief history of Oman. Qaboos immediately set about improving the country. There are now schools north to south. Everybody gets a chance to go to school. Small villages group together. They have a school there. Education is free through higher education if your scores are good enough. Universal health care. Everybody has health care. Again, groups of villages. There is a clinic, hospital for everybody, everywhere. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of paved roads. 6-lane, 4-lane, 2-lane. Almost every village has a road going to it. Many of them are paved. That's his goal, is to get every single road to every single village paved. Every village has electricity. Every village has fresh water, even if it has to be trucked in. And most of the time, it does. There are these huge blue tank trucks that ply these tiny little narrow mountain roads to get fresh water to every single village. He has created a very liberal policy with his subjects. It is a conservative country, and yet it's a very progressive country. And it's hard to envision that. It's still a very traditional Islamic, obviously an Islamic country, and yet women have full rights. They can drive cars. They can own businesses. I taught at the only state-owned university, Sultan Qaboos University, which has 15,000 students, so it's about the size of UNO. And it is split exactly men and women, 50% men, 50% women. They are in the same classroom. They have the same advantages. They can run for public office. There are four female ministers right now in the government. So it is a very, very open policy. They have all of the rights that males do within the limits of Islamic law, and there's some interesting twists in there. But for the most part, women share fully in society, and yet it is a very Islamic country still to this day. Interestingly enough, certain habits are changing. It is under Arab Islamic culture not permitted for boys and girls to talk to each other of dating age. They're not supposed to, you know, be together and except on the college campus, they can do that. But unsupervised, they're not supposed to be together. It's very difficult to date in Oman. Hence, a lot of cousins marry because you get to meet your cousin and kind of know what your cousin is like. And so there's a lot of that goes on, which is permissible. But you're not supposed to talk to the opposite sex. You're just not supposed to outside of school. So what has started to happen, I had so many students tell me about this. Everybody, of course, has a cell phone over there. They call it a mobile. Everybody has a mobile. Your family gives you your mobile, and it's how you keep in touch. Many homes don't have a landline because it's just cheaper to construct the cell network than it is to lay landlines. But many of the teenagers also have those little disposable phones, those phones that cost about $20, and they're texting each other on those, and the boys and the girls, and that's a huge taboo. I mean, that's really not permitted, and they do. And then their families don't know about these. If the family gets close, it just goes out the window because you can buy another one cheap. It doesn't matter. You just lose your phone and buy another one when the opportunity arises. So the boys and girls are talking, and it's interesting because as my students were telling me this, I was saying, you know, in a generation or two, this whole taboo about boys and girls talking is going to be gone. And they said, oh no, it's not. I said, well, that already is. It already is gone. And they said, no, no, no. And I said, yes, yes, yes. You just wait. Maybe not your siblings, your little siblings, but their children, it'll be all gone. And life will change. Oman has, as I said, it has all of the modern conveniences. Petrol, gasoline costs the equivalent of $1.20 a gallon over there. It's subsidized. It's not. It's actually should be more than that. It's subsidized, and the World Bank has said that's not sustainable. But the Sultan knows that if he raises the price, there will be rebellion. That's one of the basics. He cannot raise the price of gasoline. Not right away. And so it is the equivalent of $1.20 a gallon. It was a shock to come home. As I said, the mountains, the hillsides come right down and plunge into the ocean, and they create some of the most beautiful beaches and scenery that I've ever seen. And it was just a joy to just drive along, stop at a beach, or stop at a just pull off the road. There's not another road. There doesn't have to be a pathway. You just pull off the road and drive up to the edge of the cliff if it's a cliff, or up to the edge of the water if it's water there, and sit and, you know, dip your toes in, or just sit and watch the waves come in. It was some of the most beautiful scenery I've ever seen. And yet Muscat itself is a very modern city, as I said. There is a rule there, though, that all of the construction must have an Islamic or Arab influence. So the architecture is still very, very much Islamic Arab culture. You've seen pictures of Dubai, which is all steel and glass. That will not happen in Oman, at least in the near future. Buildings, we heard, I was never able to confirm, buildings will not be more than 10 stories high, and they will have, they have to be of a uniform or a fairly uniform color. There is some steel and glass there. They're beginning to go in that way, but it still has the arches or the curlicues that we sort of associate with Arab and Islamic culture. Sultan Qaboos University has its own mosque, and so which I'm not allowed to go in. Mosques are off limits to non-Muslims, except for the ones that are open for tourism. And there is one that the Sultan Qaboos Grand Mosque, which is a spectacular thing, opens almost every day for a few hours for people to come and visit. And it is truly spectacular. So the city, the university is only 26 years old. It was built in, it was opened in 1986. So it's just now 26, 27 years old. And from the start, the Sultan said that there would be men and women educated there. Had I had a Fulbright in the United Arab Emirates, anywhere there, I would have taught one class to the boys, got in my car, driven to a separate campus, and taught the same class to the girls. In my class, I had men and women both. They are fully integrated in the class. The women sat in the back most of the time. The boys sat in the front because women don't want the boys looking at them. They can sit side by, I mean, one side and the other. But usually the women prefer to sit in the back. There is a back door for them to come in, but they can use either door. And the interesting thing is that if the women in the class are already in the classroom, the boys cannot go in until I get there. They have to wait in the hallway until I get there, and then they'll go in with me. So it's. I had one really cute thing. There was a back door. I was still fairly new. There was a back door, and all of the four women in the class had come in that door. And so we were taking a break. It was a long class, and they were taking a break, and the women had come back in, and I said, "So that door is only for women." They said, "No, you can use that door." I said, "I can. I can go in that door." "Yes, you can go in that door." I said, "Can you come in this front door?" "Yes, we can use any door." I said, "Okay." So at the end of class, I'm putting my computer away and getting my notes, and they're kind of putting their stuff away, and the boys had left. And I said, "I can go out that door?" And they said, "Yes." And I said, "But I shouldn't." And they kind of grinned at each other, and they said, "No, you can go out that door." I said, "Okay, I'm going out that door." And I went to the back door, and they pushed it open, and they looked down the hallway both ways to make sure there were no other women in the hallway. It was so cute, and I went out the door with them. They were really great. The students there were so much fun. They were so interested in America and so eager to tell me about Oman. Sultan Qaboos Grand Mosque was built, I don't know, about 10, 12 years ago. It was finished about 12 years ago by the Sultan. It is an absolutely enormous facility, the prayer room for women. That's the women pray separately from the men. That's the women's majlis, it's called. The crystal chandelier is beautiful. And that's the first thing you see as you kind of tour the grounds and begin to look at the buildings. You see this and you think, wow, this is absolutely spectacular. I mean, there's inlaid marble and inlaid wood and carved sandstone and wood, and it's just magnificent. And then you get to the main majlis, which has, it's hard to take a picture of something that large and have it make an impression on you. Because it is absolutely enormous. It has the second largest carpet in the world, single piece carpet in the world, which was hand woven, hand tied in Iran, and then flown over in two 747s. It took two 747s to fly the carpet over and then install it where it was stitched back together. It is spectacular. I mean, that's all I can say. The chandelier that hangs in the very middle of it weighs 9 tons. That's a 9-ton chandelier, crystal, manufactured in Austria, and installed by very strong workers or a really powerful crane, because it's huge. And then there are smaller chandeliers all the way around, and all the carved intricate wood and stone there. going into a mosque is the only place that Elaine, wave your hand, is the only place that Elaine had to wear a veil. In no other place are Westerners required to wear a veil. All Omani women are required to, even foreign Muslim women, if it's not their country's tradition to wear veils, they don't have to. Many, many Muslim women do, even if they're from, like, you don't have to wear a veil in Egypt, but many do. But Western women are not required to. They're not required to put an abaya on, the black outer garment that women are required to wear in Muscat. That you simply dress modestly, you know, cover your shoulders, cover below your knees and things like that. But other than that, only walking into the mosque is – and obviously she didn't have to cover all her hair, just the top of her head. And they give you the veil. When we were in – we did visit the Sheikh Zayed Mosque in Abu Dhabi, which is the largest mosque, has the largest carpet in the world. And Elaine and our daughter, who was with us, were both required to put an abaya on, the black abaya and the black hijab. And that's just one of the differences. I have to talk for a moment about the native dress, and especially the abaya, because we have mistaken ideas about the abaya. The black abaya, in Oman, at least, is required for all the female students on campus. Many of the women in Muscat also wear it. When you get outside of Muscat, they don't wear it. It is not an Omani thing. It is not truly an Islamic thing. It's a Saudi influence, and actually the Omanis resent it quite a bit, that they've been sort of coerced into wearing this thing. They hate it, and they're especially jealous because the boys get to wear white. In a very sunny climate, they have to wear black, and they know the difference quite starkly. It's easy to make some generalizations about the abaya. First of all, in Oman, it's black, but it is not plain. I have seen abayas that will run $2,500, $3,000, and they have pleats, they have embroidery, they have designs, they have crystals, they have sequins, they have... they have all around the back. They have the hijab used to the scarf veil used to be black. It is now every color under the sun, and they are very proud of that. Every now and then, the abaya will sort of fall open, maybe accidentally in front of the boys, and the women are dressed to the nines under that with some of the most beautiful dresses, skin tight, and I'm talking painted on blue jeans, 6-inch, 4-inch heels underneath that. The makeup is spectacular. These women in Oman are aggressive. They are ambitious. They want to learn. They are not. It's easy to see a group of them walking and think, oh, they're all subservient and they all, you know, bow to this. They don't. They have their own opinions. They have their own minds. They are very, very impressive women. The boys, on the other hand, wear a white, usually white dish dasha, the white long white globe, which is perfect for desert climate. There's lots of circulation, shall we say, for the boys. It covers the arms. You have to be covered. I came back and people said, you don't have much of a tan. No, because you cover. I mean, even when I was out, a long sleeve shirt, because the sun will beat you down. And so white reflects the heat. It keeps you cool. All the boys have to wear a cap, too. They have to cover their heads with either a kuma or the turban that you see them in. It doesn't matter which one they wear. But they don't take nearly as much care with their appearance as the women do, and they tend to be a little scruffy. The rule on campus is that the dish dasha has to be white. You can actually get one in any color, pinstripes. You can get blue, gray, green, purple, red, brown. You can get all colors under the sun, but on campus it has to be white. And I was told that if it's not white, I can kick the student out of the classroom. I never did. And boys, teenage boys being teenage boys, push the boundaries. And there is every color of Dish Dasha on that campus. And as far as I know, they don't get in trouble for that. But I could if I wanted to, I was told. I would never do that. The ceremonial palace is actually in the town of Muscat. Nobody actually lives in that palace. It is Queen Elizabeth stayed there the last time she visited. The Sultan has other palaces that he much prefers. This one's kind of isolated. And, well, it's not isolated. It's in the middle of the city. He prefers a quieter one. But it's the ceremonial one. It's the one that everybody has goes to visit, even the Omanis, to get their photos taken in front of, or to, you know, just to say that they had visited there. But it's purely ceremonial. You'll see depictions of it every now and then. Muscat is a port city. Obviously, it's right on the sea of Oman, the Gulf. It has a beautiful harbor, a really nice harbor. It's not particularly big. They can get three or four container vessels in at any one time, and they do. There's usually something in there. The QE2 docked there one day while we were visiting. We went down and watched that right at Easter last year. We went down and watched that, but it was fun just to go down. And the smaller boats that are traditional are called dhows, D-H-O-W, and dhow just means boat. It just means that's just the word for boat. So there are all sorts of dhows, but they're great fun to take a ride on. Early in our stay, the university arranged a trip for new faculty members, new foreign faculty members. And they took us to a place called Nakhl, a town called Nakhl, and there's a wadi there. A wadi is like an arroyo. It's a dry riverbed, except some of them aren't dry. They're actually spring-fed from the mountains. And this one happens to be a hot spring. And so as we were walking up, there was a little boy whose dad had been giving him a bath right there in the stream. And my wife said, oh, the poor little guy, everybody's walking past him and he's all naked. He didn't look upset about that at all. He looked like he was having just the time of his life. His dad had given him a bath and had played with him, and he was splashing in the water, and he looked like he was having a really great time. People flock to this just to have picnics, to have a recreation day, to have some time out. Omanis are great family people. Their family units are very, very strong. Dads play with the children. Moms take care of everybody, and it's really a fun experience to see. This particular one, as I said, is a hot spring, and they had actually built a little kind of a pool, and there were several people who were giving their older children a bath in the pool. You haul the kid down there and let him splash around in the water a little bit and play, and then you lather up the washcloth and scrub him down good, and then let him play in the water. And I stood back for a moment and I thought, I think this is what paradise is supposed to look like. I just think this is what it's supposed to be: green children, laughter, water, fun. Bright sunshine, leafy greens. I mean, it was just it just took my breath away for a few moments, and I just thought it was beautiful. Oman has about 3 million people, so it's about the population of Iowa. 750,000 of those are expatriates. So about a quarter of the population comes from someplace else. Most of the places that they come from are India, Pakistan, other Arab nations to some extent, Philippines, Malaysia, and then some of the African nations as well. And one of the problems is that one of the social problems there is that Omanis don't like to get their hands dirty. So it's the expatriates who come in and fill the labor jobs, the poor-paying jobs, the jobs where their passport is confiscated when they get here in order to make them fulfill the terms of the contract. They really don't have very much freedom. They're not paid all that well. All of their money goes back to their families at home. They live in labor camps. Somebody died in a labor camp fire the other day. The labor camps are flimsy wood, plywood camps that are thrown up, and there will be two or three or four people living in a very small room there. and it gets to be extremely crowded. And it's a wonder that there aren't more fires and more deaths. And then, of course, they have Americans, Canadians, Brits, Australians to do some of the higher-end things. Indians run many of the businesses there. They can't own a business, but they can certainly run the businesses there. Many people from Holland to come in and work in the oil industry. So there really is a rich mix, a great diversity in Oman that you wouldn't think it would have, but there is. We went to a Catholic church there. There are four Catholic churches in Oman. There are several Protestant churches. There are some Hindu temples. The Sultan has a very, very tolerant policy toward other religions, and they are freely and openly practiced. Not off-site. You cannot proselytize. You cannot hold Bible meetings in your home, but you can at the church, and he actually donates the land for the churches. We were among the only white faces in the entire crowd in that Catholic church. There were many Africans and many Indians and Asian cultures that were there. It was fascinating, really being in a minority like that. We were not mistreated. We were never threatened. We never felt threatened. People loved us going to the church and being in among them. I sang in a choir that had people from all over the world. There was a community choir there, and I got to sing in it, and I was one of the very few Americans that was in the choir. They came from everywhere else, and it was such a great experience. Our Christmas winter concert included Christmas carols from all over the world, South Africa and Holland and England and Norway, and I mean it just came from everywhere, mostly European nations, but some African nations as well. I've talked for 40 minutes, and I tell people I can talk for 4 hours and bore you forever, but I do want to give a chance to let you ask some rather specific questions if you have them.
Chris, were you ever threatened, or did you ever feel threatened during your stay?
That's a really good question, and the answer is no. We were told by the embassy, we had to go through a security briefing at the embassy, and we were told that our biggest danger was on the roads. They are notoriously terrible drivers. Last year they had 1,100 traffic deaths. In a country of 3 million people, can you imagine if Iowa had 1,100 traffic deaths, the uproar that there would be? They are notoriously bad drivers. Every other crime is a crime of opportunity. If I had left my briefcase with a computer in it, it was likely to disappear, but actually it wasn't likely to disappear. They are truly honest people. There is almost no violent crime. What violent crime there is usually one Indian against another, or a Pakistani against another, or something like that. The Omanis themselves are very, very, very peaceful people. We never, ever felt in danger, which leads me to when I wrote the little promo for this in the newsletter, I said that I would answer two questions. Number one is what was my favorite experience there? Our daughter and her boyfriend came over to visit us at Christmas time last year, and we were on our way to a resort area, but we had stopped at one of these recreation areas at a wadi with pools and water, and people go there all the time. And on our way, I took a wrong turn, and we ended up in this little village. And as long as we were in the village, I wanted my daughter to see one of the small villages. People in Oman live in compounds, and they're not wealthy. These people are not wealthy. They are of very modest means, most of them. So we're walking back to the car, and this man steps out of his compound with three children, a girl and two boys. And he saw us down the street. Obviously, we're dressed as Westerners, as foreigners. And he said, "Hello." And we said, "Hello. Where are you from?" He said, "We're from America." He said, "Oh, America, please come in for coffee." And we did. And we sat down with he and the three children, and we had dates and oranges and apples and bananas and grapes and coffee and water and sweets. And he just wanted to talk to us. His English was limited. He just wanted to talk to us. This happened to us four or five times while we were there. And as we left, I said to my daughter, who lives in Arkansas, I said, "So the next time you see four foreign people walking past your front door, are you going to just invite them in for coffee sight unseen?" And she said, "No." And I said, "But they do here, and they do. And that's my favorite experience."
Question on oil. I assume that their economy is based 100% on oil revenue, and this questioner wants to know, do they refine their own petroleum, or does gasoline have to be brought in?
There is some refining for their own gasoline, but mostly they ship it. It is sold. I think their biggest market is China. I think they sell mostly to China. They are not a member of OPEC. They do not belong to OPEC. They market their oil on their own, and the economy is based on oil. Every year the budget is set, and I think the budget when we were there was set based on an oil price of $75 a barrel. And of course, it was selling at that time for $100, $105, $110 a barrel. So there was quite a national surplus.
Is there some level of democracy? What if I, for example, went outside and a building there with a sign protesting the government, protesting the ruler? What would happen to me?
What a great question. The Sultan is an absolute monarch. He makes the rules. The interesting thing is he is slowly teaching them how to be a democracy. In 1994, he decreed that an elected majlis, which simply means meeting, a shura, an elected shura council, would be elected. They didn't really have any power. He appointed who was going to be chair, and they sort of went on and learned how to meet and how to do things like that. While we were there, they held a shura election, and he opened the new session in November of 11, and he said, now you will elect your own leader. You will elect your own chairman. I will not appoint him. You now have the power to review the budget. You can call in ministers to investigate them. You can ask them questions. You have that power to do. Slowly, instead of saying, okay, elect somebody and now you're a democracy, in a country that has never known democracy, he is teaching them how to be a democracy. And I think if he gets another 10 years on earth, he will pass from this mortal coil as a constitutional monarch rather than an absolute monarch. I think he's slowly taking his country that way because he has no heirs. He has no children. He is not married. He was briefly early in his life. He divorced early, and he has no children. There is sort of a plan for succession, but I think what he really would prefer is that when he dies, his country is ready to have an elected council and a prime minister run it, and the Sultan would simply be head of state and not head of the government. He right now is the prime minister. He right now is the foreign affairs secretary. And so he's moving them slowly that way. Now, as to criticism, no, you do not criticize the Sultan. You do not. There are 14 or 15 bloggers who are in jail right now at this moment because they have criticized the Sultan, and that is not tolerated. So while it is a very free and open society, there are still problems, and there are some very severe press problems. And there are some very severe coverage problems just in the way the news is covered.
Is this a country of privileged Omanis, and then on the other side, a working class in poverty? When do you foresee a working class revolt?
Well, there was one, actually, in February of 10. 11, February of 11, there was a small one. It is exactly that. It is a country of privileged and poor. Unlike some of the oil-rich countries, you don't get a paycheck for being Omani. You have to work. Boys get a plot of land when they get married to build a house on. They don't get the money for the house. They just get the plot of land. They have to come up with the rest of the money themselves, and they have to work for a paycheck. I don't know if there will be a revolt that way. They've become a very peaceful people. What they are angry about is corruption in government, and there is corruption in government, and they're very, very angry about that. They're very, very angry about siphoning away the resources. And they're really especially angry. This is one of the problems that Oman – this is another problem that Oman has is with its economy. It is oil-based, but there's not that much oil in Oman. And it will run out in the next 50 to 60 years. It will run out. And the Sultan knows that it's going to run out. He knows this. He has some of the greatest engineers and geologists in the world, and he knows that the oil is going to run out. What he has to do then is move his economy to be based on something else. And so far, the Omanis are not cooperating. They, for some reason, think it's going to last forever. And he's trying to get light industry and, you know, information technology and that kind of stuff going. And while there's a little bit, it's certainly not enough to carry an economy that will run out of oil. And so that will be an interesting development to watch over the next 40 years or so.
If there are severe press restrictions, what did you teach? Were your lectures censored?
No, my lectures were not censored. And in fact, I gave two lectures on freedom of the press, two public lectures on freedom of the press. And one was at a – both of them were at colleges. And at one college – one was at my own college and one was at another one. And at one of the students said, so do you think we should – are you telling us that we should go to jail for our stories? And I didn't really anticipate that question, but I knew it was a possibility of it coming up. And I said, pick your battles carefully. You are allowed to cover social issues. You are allowed to cover, crime. You are allowed to cover, national news and things like that. You simply can't criticize the Sultan or the decisions of the country. We had an interesting thing happen while I was there, very, very briefly. In the uprising in February of 10, in all of the midst of it, it was only in a couple of towns. It wasn't this huge Arab Spring thing. But it happened at that same time. What are the Muscat has five Arab language and four English language newspapers. One each is owned, controlled by the government. The others are privately owned. So there is a press there. One of them ran an article that was very, very critical of the Minister of Justice, the equivalent of our Attorney General. And the Minister of Justice sued the newspaper saying that he had been insulted. No libel, just he had been insulted. And I'm thinking, how many of our attorneys general have been insulted over the years in newspapers? Like every single one, right? And of course, they don't do anything. So they ran this article and they were sued. And the judgment came down while we were there. And the newspaper, the editor, the reporter, and the insider that they had in the ministry were all found guilty. They were all fined 1,000 reals, which is $2,600. The newspaper was fined more. All of them were sentenced to 1 month in jail. So this is not civil. This is criminal. And the newspaper was – no, they were sentenced to 6 months in jail. The newspaper was ordered closed for 1 month. Well, they all appealed. And the appeal came down at Christmas time, right? Like the day before Christmas, which they don't celebrate there, so it didn't have any significance. In the meantime, the Sultan had opened the Shura Council, as I mentioned, and one of the things he said in his speech is that we as leaders of the country must be more tolerant to the criticism that is leveled against us, and we must have an ear for this, which everybody saw as a really sharp rap across the knuckles of the Minister of Justice. But Omanis don't like to embarrass people. He wouldn't call him out by name. They're very uncomfortable about embarrassment. The judgment came down. It was reaffirmed. Everybody was guilty. All of the sentences were suspended. Nobody went to jail. Nobody paid a fine. 3 months later, the Minister of Justice was replaced. So it was interesting to watch the whole cycle of this and how it played out.
Are Omanis Shia or Sunni?
They are neither. And that's a really good question. They are of a very minority sect called the Ibadi sect, Ibadi. The Sultan is Abadi, and it's actually an African sect. Because of Zanzibar and their association with Tanzania, the Abadi sect became the dominant sect in Oman. Oman was one of the very first Islamic nations in the Middle East. It converted very, very early. But he became the Abadi sect. But the Sultan has decreed that a mosque is a mosque, and it doesn't matter if it is dominant Sunni or Shia or Abadi. Any Muslim must be allowed to pray there. You cannot bar any Muslim from praying in your mosque. You must be tolerant of all of the sects of Islam. And early on, we were hoping to make a documentary about religious tolerance because Christianity is allowed there. Hinduism and things like that are allowed to be practiced and preached there. And I had a chance. We didn't get funding to do this. But early on, I got a chance to interview the bishop, the Catholic bishop, who's actually based in Abu Dhabi. He came in for a week to visit the parishes, and I got an interview with him. And I had asked my boss, Obeid Al-Sharksi, if a student could help videotape it. And he said, yes, call Nasser and ask him to help. So I called Nasser, and I arranged with him, and I said, show up at this time at this place. And he did, with two friends. And they shot the interview for me. It was about a half-hour interview. It was really, really good. He was just a wonderful interview. And he at the end, we were breaking the equipment down and putting it away, and Nasser said, what is this for? And I said, well, it's a documentary we're hoping to do, and he's about religious tolerance. And he said, you mean like Islam and Christians? And I said, well, yeah, that, but also, you know, Abadi and Shia and Sunni. And he smiled and he said, I'm Abadi and he's Sunni and he's Shia. It was right there in that room. We had all of the elements of the story were right in that room.
Time for one more question, depending on how long you take. and I'll read this, but I think it leads to a larger question. With the recent acquisition of Current TV by Al Jazeera, do you think this will correct the leanings of the news? My larger question is, you know, can Omanis view any kind of television they can get from any place?
Yes and yes. The acquisition or the takeover by Al Jazeera. I actually got to see Al Jazeera. I flew up to Qatar and I spent an afternoon at Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is a fascinating place. Al Jazeera English is mostly staffed by Brits, Americans, Canadians, Australians, all of us who can't find work in American media, and can find work with them. And it has sort of that sort of view, but of course it does present a slightly different worldview, just like CNN International does, quite honestly, or BBC does. And so yes, I think there will be some minor correction. There are a lot of places that don't like Al Jazeera in the Arab nations. They think Al Jazeera is way too honest, and they're not particularly pleased with Al Jazeera. As for watching anything, yes, they can watch anything, but not pornography. Pornography is blocked. Internet, you can't buy it. You can't. I mean, they're like magazines and stuff. And I assume that things like the Playboy Channel would be blocked too. I didn't have access to that. So, or try. But I did. I honestly tried some pornography sites just to try them out. And the slate comes up and says this is not permitted to view. It's against our cultural and religious views. So,
Chris Allen, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's speaker has been Chris Allen, Associate Professor of Communications at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and former president of the Omaha Press Club. The title of his presentation has been Oman, the Gem of Arabia. He talked about his Fulbright year experience in this Islamic country on the Saudi Peninsula. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, January 24, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Friday, March 22nd at 12 noon. At that time, we'll hear a debate between the five candidates for mayor of the city of Omaha in the upcoming April 2nd primary election, incumbent Mayor Jim Suttle seeking his second term, and challengers, former Omaha City Council President Dan Welch, current City Councilwoman Jean Stothert, Omaha businessman Dave Nabity, and current member of the Nebraska Unicameral Brad Ashford. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.